In deze podcast spreek ik met Dr. Anthony Chafee over eten als onze voorouders, de carnivore aanpak. Dr. Anthony Chafee, a huge welcome to the Keto Podcast and a big thank you for making time for this talk in your unbelievably busy schedule. I believe this is your very first interview for a Dutch podcast show, am I right?
I would think so, yes, it's definitely the first.
Yeah, I couldn't find another one, so it must be the first, mm-hmm. So the honor is all mine. Well, we met last June in Switzerland, and I must admit that even though I'm quite familiar with many influential people in the keto space, I did not know who you were. So that all changed when I ended up at a dinner table with you and a whole group of people. And I was totally amazed to hear what you all talked about. So I quickly did a little research and discovered more about you and your background. And I must say, I'm a fan now. Because there are so many things that you talk about and I can wholeheartedly agree with. And I especially appreciate the level and the depth of what you show on the topics of the ketogenic diet and the carnivore diet. But I can imagine that there are more people in the Netherlands who may not yet know you. So let me start with a short introduction. You're an American MD, medical doctor, who studied science and medicine in the US and in Ireland, I believe. And now you're practicing as a brain surgeon in Perth, Australia.
Neurosurgical registrar, but not a full neurosurgeon. And I also have a practice in optimizing metabolic health and preventative medicine.
Yeah. Okay. Great. But that's not all. You're also, if you were a professional rugby player in America and England, so that's quite a career change. Is there anything I've left out that you would like to tell us more about so we can get to know you a little better?
Oh, that's really the main things. You know, I always wanted to be a doctor, and so that was always the plan. But I had a lot of athletic ambitions as well, and so I took time off from my academic goals to pursue my athletic goals, and so and then I sort of did both. So I would play rugby in university, and then took a break and was just playing rugby full time, and then went to medical school, but then kept playing rugby after that as well. But yeah, that's the main thing. And that's how, the diet and then lifestyle things have really played a big role, active role in my life. Was for, I wanted to be as good of an athlete as I could be. I wanted to be as healthy as I could be. And now applying those same principles to my patient population, I'm finding that they're extraordinarily benefited by these same principles as well. So it all sort of ties together.
Yeah. Great. Well, the main reason I ask you for this interview is because you've been a carnivore now for about 5 years, I believe.
Nearly 7 years, and then I was 5 years in my early 20s, so 12 of the last 20 years. I had a bit of a hiatus, but yeah. my early 20s, I was full carnivore, even though it wasn't called carnivore. I just learned how toxic plants were in college, taking botany and biology and cancer biology, and I was like, I'm not eating any of these things, and I cut them all out of my diet. And felt absolutely fantastic, and then sort of slipped back into my old ways of very healthy eating, of a whole food omnivorous diet, mostly eating meat, but still eating some fruits and vegetables because you're supposed to eat fruits and vegetables. And that was really my only interest in eating them, was that I was supposed to. And then coming back to that and really rediscovering the principles behind the human carnivorous diet and the benefits of that. About 7 years ago when I was 38, I'm 44 now, turning 45 in January. So it'll be 7 years again, another 7 years here in February.
Yeah. And you already touched upon that a little bit, because as a neurosurgeon, I mean, what led you to become so passionate about nutrition in the carnivore diet?
Well, just because it works, and it really helps people's health. It helps my health, and I noticed that in those first 5 years that I did it, in my early 20s, I've never been healthier. I've never felt better. I've never been more athletic. I never had more endurance. And then at 25 and a half, all of a sudden I didn't feel as good and I couldn't perform to the same level. I could still outperform a lot of other people, but I still wasn't myself, and I didn't know why that was. And I eventually just chalked it up to age, and that I was just, if you just start dying at 25, it's just life's just downhill from there. Yeah. But of course that's not true. And We're actually designed genetically to live 120 years on average based on our genes. I was taught that in genetics 24 years ago. So the idea that we should just start dying and falling off at 25 doesn't make any sense. And it's also not true. So looking at that and then sort of rediscovering it in my late 30s, I found that it was, the reason I was feeling so good in my early 20s. I realized, okay, that's what I was doing. Humans actually are carnivores as a species. We've been apex predators for over 2 million years. Apex predators are by definition carnivores. And so that's what I was doing. That's how I was eating. That's how I was living. And of course, if you feed an animal what it's designed to eat, like a zoo animal or a domestic pet, if you feed them outside of their naturally evolved, evolutionary based, biologically appropriate diet, created diet, whatever you want to say, or biologically appropriate diet anyway, they get sick and they get problems and they get the same diseases that we get. They're getting these human diseases. They're getting dogs and cats are getting diabetes. Animals in the zoo, if you feed them the wrong things, they'll get obesity, they'll get lupus, they'll get all these other sorts of issues. So when I realized that, it was a personal change for me. I just didn't want to eat anything harmful to my body. I said, okay, right, that's I had it right. I was onto something even accidentally. I'm going to go back to doing that. And I felt massively better. It improved my health. I slimmed up and got in very good shape very quickly. I felt so good that I went back within a few weeks and started playing high level rugby again. It felt amazing. I felt like I was 22 again. I felt better at 38 with only, a couple, a few weeks, couple months under my belt in training than I did at 28. Playing professional rugby and training as a full-time job. And so I started really digging into the research and the literature and saying, okay, what do we know? What can we prove? I came across all the information on ketogenic diets, and that made sense because carnivore diet is a ketogenic diet. And when you take away carbohydrates and sugars, what's left? You have to replace that with fat and protein. And where does that fat and protein come from? Largely from meat. And so carnivore diet or the ketogenic diets, most of them in these studies that show massive benefits to specific health outcomes and medical issues are a high fat meat-based ketogenic diets. Carnivore diet is a high fat meat-based ketogenic diet. And so you can anticipate similar benefits from doing this as well. So I just started digging in and trying to find as much literature and evidence that I could. And it worked. And so it worked for me. It worked for my family. I started talking to other doctors about it. It made sense to them. They started applying it to their life, to their patient life. And I just started seeing this web of sort of influence around me of people benefiting. And then I started seeing for specific health outcomes. And I'd have a patient with a specific health outcome. And I'd say, listen, have you thought about this? Have you looked into nutrition? A patient with Crohn's disease, there are randomized controlled trials in humans with Crohn's disease that show that different dietary interventions, such as ketogenic diets, where they remove carbohydrates and fiber, that people can stay in remission up to 51 months without medication. So how are we saying that Crohn's disease is not influenced by diet? Of course it is. And we have studies to prove that. It's just they don't get taught to us in medical school or residency. It's all the medications. The medications get taught to us. And that's because the pharmaceutical companies and the food companies, they dictate a lot of what we learn in these training programs. And so you have to, but the evidence is there and you just have to find it. So I looked at it, I found the evidence, I started applying it to my patient population. You can do this in neurosurgery, you can do this in anything. And I just saw people's lives get better. Chronic pain in neurosurgery. We have, spinal nerve root compressions and different sorts of injuries and neurological conditions that you can treat surgically. And sometimes it's not enough. Sometimes those nerves are permanently damaged. They permanently have pain, permanently have weakness. You change their diet and they improve. Or traumas. You have TBI, traumatic brain injuries. There, that we already have robust data showing that people going on a high-fat, meat-based ketogenic diet has a massive improvement for the recovery and traumatic brain injuries and other sorts of neurological insults. But this is already something that has a lot of data for you. Just it's just a matter of the application. And so having more tools at your disposal as a doctor, as a clinician, that you can use for your patients in certain situations. So I have, I, you know, obviously we cover trauma and we have head traumas. And sometimes they're having surgeries and they're having major recoveries from neurological injuries from that. Okay, so you talk about that's a perfectly appropriate time to talk about diet and nutrition and how a ketogenic diet can benefit them. And it doesn't have to be a carnivore diet, but I think that's the best form of a ketogenic diet, certainly like a plant-free ketogenic diet for various reasons. Plants have toxins. This is a well-known fact, and they have about a million different defensive chemicals that they use to deter animals and insects from eating them. Okay, so if you have these things that have deleterious effects and you don't need them from a nutritional standpoint because you get everything you need in the proportion that you need them from meat and you want to be ketogenic, then eating solely meat, just like our ancestors have for millions of years, especially during the ice ages, and many peoples are doing right now, well, traditionally anyway, a lot of people have moved away from their traditional diets, like the Inuit, like the Native Americans in the Great Plains, like the Native Australian Aboriginals, like the Nenet, like the Maasai. Maasai aren't ketogenic. They drink milk, but they are, they just eat meat and milk and blood. That these people are fabulously healthy. They don't have the chronic diseases that we face. And I think that we should really learn from that. And when you apply that, you say, hey, listen, you try this and this can help you and you get benefits from it. You really are helping people in more than one way. We pigeonhole ourselves as clinicians and specialists and say, okay, well, I'm doing the neurosurgery part. This person came in with a subdural hematoma and I went and did a decompression and took off their skull and evacuated the hematoma. And now it's recovery, making sure there's no infections and making sure everybody's okay. Great job done. And then on to the rehab team. Well, you can add more to that as well if you talk to them about diet and lifestyle as well, because that is has a huge role to play. And you as a doctor, as a clinician, have a very big impact on that person. If you say, hey, you need to eat this way to maximize your recovery, people are more likely to listen than if someone else were to tell them, if a family member were to tell them or something like that. So you do hold a lot of weight in your recommendations. And if the evidence is there, then the evidence is there. And if you're benefiting, and that just allows you as a doctor to benefit your patients even more. And the list goes on. I mean, it's just endless. And now my main practice is just optimizing people's health and metabolic health. And these chronic diseases largely go away when you just change their diet and lifestyle. It's amazing.
It sure is. And I was wondering, is the a carnivore or ketogenic diet suitable for everyone, or are there any people or situations in particular where a carnivore diet is not recommended? I would love to hear on that.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the thing is that we're all humans, and it's so you have to sort of ask the question, like, is there any situation that a carnivore diet wouldn't be appropriate for a leopard or a lion or a whale? It's just like, well, no, the food is species specific. That's what it comes down to, is people that say, well, based on your blood type. Well, lions have different blood types, parrots have different blood types, animals have different blood types, but they don't change their diet as a result of that. Okay, well, can women do this? Okay, well, female and males of all species in nature predominantly eat the same thing. They just may eat more or less as per their demand. Pregnancy, same thing. Mammals in general will drink their mother's milk and then they'll get weaned onto their mother's diet. And then they'll eat that diet for the rest of their life and wean their children onto that diet as well. So it is appropriate for everybody at every stage in life, for every gender, for every ethnic background, and for every health condition. In fact, it's more important for people that are more infirm, that are at the extremes of age, and that are unwell, because optimal nutrition is optimal. And so if you are unwell, if you are growing and developing or elderly and you have a lower threshold for harm, then it's even more beneficial, especially in development. Obviously, that's the most important time, is when we're developing, but you only get one chance to develop. You're never going to grow up as big, tall, strong, and intelligent as you were if you were going to develop optimally and eat optimally. So yeah, I haven't the only situation I've ever sort of had a bit of a moment about is PKU, phenylketonuria. So you have this more phenylalanine, and this is abundant in all sorts of different foods. But you know, there's a lot of it in meat, and the question is, okay, well, as an adult, typically you don't have to avoid phenylalanine, even if you have PKU, because it doesn't damage the development of the brain after the brain is developed. So after sort of age 18, and you know, like Coca-Cola has this stuff in it, and so you know, it's not like you're going to avoid it just by avoiding meat. And typically after a certain age, you know, you don't have to really avoid this stuff. Okay, but what about early on? Is this just a genetic abnormality that is just not compatible with life under those conditions, and that this would be someone who had that genetic change would just have died? I don't know. I mean, kids with PKU breastfeed, right? And so, okay, what, how is that different? You know, because they're still getting exposed to this and they're not dying, they're not getting extremely sick from breast milk. So you can have a genetic predisposition, but then you need the environmental trigger. So is it just the exposure of phenylalanine that's causing the problem, or is it the exposure of phenylalanine in the system that we are seeing it, mm-hmm. which is on this standard, you know, garbage diet and eating all sorts of different sorts of things? Does that change something? I mean, I see people with very severe genetic issues that actually don't have a problem, and their problems actually reverse. Their genetic problems don't manifest as phenotypical expressions when they go onto a carnivore diet. And we're learning a lot more about those. But I just interviewed a lady who's, I can't remember the specific gene malformation, but she had, it damaged her gut, and basically the gut is dysfunctional and they have to get ileostomies, and it just doesn't work properly. These kids get extremely emaciated, extremely undernourished. Their body can't absorb food. They're just very, very sick. They generally die within a few years, and it's a very, very painful existence and painful death, unfortunately. And she came to a carnivore diet and actually saw this reversal of her health. And it was sort of a slow process, but she saw these definite improvements happening and happening and happening. And now she's just a happy little girl developing normally. And she's lived past her expected life expectancy. And she's completely normal now. She still has the ileostomy because they're just like, ooh, let's just wait until everything's just right. And until, you know, we're all happy with this. But right now, things are normal. She's developing normally. Yeah. And normally it causes, intelligence delay and learning disabilities. And she's completely fine. You know, she doesn't have any of these sorts of things. So it could be that with PKU, you may have to think about it. I haven't seen enough to, I have seen people dabble with it, but yeah, they were already adults. And there was, so there's no problem there, but there probably wouldn't be anyway. But I can't say for sure one way or the other with kids. So that would be the only question mark that I would have, would be PKU. Mm. But I would suspect there would be the same sort of thing with like that little girl with that genetic issue with her bowel, that when you're eating what you're supposed to eat, you know, that phenotype doesn't get expressed because you're eating properly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And well, you've mentioned that plant toxins can be harmful. Are plants always a bad idea for us because of the anti-nutrients, or can they be mm-hmm. neutral or even beneficial to some people or in certain situations or in certain dosages?
Well, certainly in certain situations, as in survival, you know, if we're starving and we can't get all the meat that we need, then, you know, that's a very benefit. Huge benefit to survival is that humans have a bit more of a range. Our ancestors were herbivorous about 6 to 8 million years ago, and then they started switching to meat and had a sort of an omnivorous diet. We're eating more and more meat until around 2.5 million years ago when the ice ages hit, and a lot of the early humans actually went extinct and they died off. The ones that were able to survive were our ancestors, Homo habilis, who actually went apex predator. And they were able to survive as apex predators, taking down large game with tools and intelligence. And a lot of people say, oh, no, they ran away towards the equator and where all the fruit was. No, actually, the ones that ran away towards the equator where the fruit was all died. They're not here anymore. They're no longer with us. Homo habilis is still around, and Homo habilis actually went up north into the ice. That's what the fossil record shows us, that they didn't run away from the ice. They actually attacked up into the ice, presumably because that's where their preferred game was, up there. And we know that humans have been thriving in the Arctic Circle during the ice ages. And there's nothing to eat in the Arctic Circle during an ice age other than meat, animals, and plants don't grow in those conditions. So we have this adaptability, and we come from an herbivorous past. It's although millions of years ago. So we have some defenses, and we've been able to use that to our advantage especially when the megafauna died out about 12 to 15,000 years ago, and we had to survive. Okay, so what the hell do we do? Well, some people figured out we could eat some plants, but they didn't just necessarily eat the raw plants. They, through intelligence, through technology, we were able to figure out how to treat them chemically in order to lower the toxic load and increase bioavailability. Because that's another way that plants defend themselves, is not just by being toxic, but by not being very nutritious. They have nutrients, they have things that are very good for you. They're living things, they have things that are good for other living things, which is why everything tries to eat everything else, because they're trying to get nutrients from each other.
Yeah.
And so they have these nutrients, but it's in their best interest to not have them accessible to you. So it's this concept of bioavailability. They're bound up in ways that we don't have the enzymes to break down, which is proof positive that we are not designed to eat them. We don't have the biological apparatus to break down these chemical bonds and make them as nutritious as possible, or break down all the toxins in the most effective and safe way. But we can do that by fermentation. We can do that by cooking some of these things. We can do that by treating them with ash and lye and clay, and to draw out some of these toxins and to break some of these chemical bonds and release some of these nutrients. So in Mesoamerica, where they developed corn, which is a totally man-made plant that does not exist in nature, they didn't just eat corn or roasted corn or anything like that. They specially prepared it. I believe it's a 7-step chemical process called nishtamalization. That's where the word tamale comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do this to corn, and this would lower the toxic load and increase the bioavailability. So it would make it relatively safer and much more nutritious. And so obviously that's more beneficial. And so when we saw that as Europeans, we said like, oh, great, corn grows so easily. It's a great crop. You can spread it all over the place and tastes good. And they took the corn, but they didn't take the technique. And so everyone started growing corn and eating a lot of corn, especially people that were less wealthy, poor people would eat more corn because it was cheap and it was available and it was easy to grow.
Yeah.
And they were all, a lot of these people were getting sick and getting something called pellagra, which is, they thought it was an infectious disease. It looked like leprosy. People's skin was peeling off. And they were like, oh gosh, this is an infection. They figured out that it wasn't an infection, but it was actually a vitamin deficiency for niacin. It was a niacin deficiency. But this is after hundreds of thousands of people died in the early 1900s. And so you had all these people die. This is why, like in the 1930s and 40s, they started fortifying cereals with niacin. That's why they're still to this day fortified with niacin. And that's why, because people were dying from lack of niacin. The irony is that corn has an abundance of niacin. It's just bound up in ways that we can't access. And so unless it goes through nishtamalization, you're not going to get the niacin and other sorts of things. So in those circumstances, as a survival food, if you don't have anything, if you don't have access to meat and things like that, plants are a really important option for survival. You know, when a lion runs out of meat, it's dead. It doesn't have any other options. We do have options. Mm. So I think primarily for survival, and also medicinally, we have compounds in plants that we've found to be beneficial for multiple health issues. But, it's estimated that the number 3 cause of death is medical mistakes, right? So it's not like medicine is safe, right? You have to use these things carefully. All medicine is a toxin that provides more benefit than harm under certain circumstances. But if you are outside of that circumstance, it's only causing the harm. And so you need to be aware of that. And so if you are going to eat these things as a food source for survival or just pleasure, if that's what you want to do, I think that the best way to do it is looking back, okay, how were people preparing these foods traditionally? What was the traditional way of doing this? The fermentation processes, the nystagmization, the vine ripening, tomatoes, blanching it, taking the skins off, taking the seeds out, and then boiling the pulp. That's how you made pasta sauce. That's how people ate tomatoes before. Now it's like, oh no, green tomatoes are fine. No, they're not. They have way more lectins, way more solanine, way more defense chemicals. The folk wisdom historically was that green tomatoes are poisonous. You do not eat them. You only eat vine ripened tomatoes. And there are studies showing that specifically in tomatoes, that if you pick them while they're green, they don't detoxify when they ripen in the box. You have to ripen on the vine. It's the plant that pulls the toxins out. They don't just disappear. And so if you're going to eat plants, I don't think you need to, certainly. If like from a nutritional standpoint, you're not missing anything by not eating plants from a nutrition standpoint. If you want to eat plants, or you need to eat plants because you don't have access to meat or can't afford meat, or you're in a situation where it's just not accessible, then I would be very careful about the plants that you eat. Try to get ones that have lower toxic load and ones that are prepared in a more traditional fashion that again lowers that toxic load even more and releases more of those nutrients to make them more bioavailable. There's actually a great book on that called Eat Like a Human, from a professor of paleoanthropology and archaeology at University of Maryland, a friend of mine, Dr. Bill Schindler. I probably actually have his book back there. And he talks about this, talking about this is the evidence for what humans have been eating since humans have been humans and beyond. And when we started eating plants, it was through intelligence, it was through technology, and it was recently because we sort of had to. And they have these different sort of techniques. So he talks about all these different sorts of techniques to lower the toxic load of these plants and increase bioavailability. So that's what I would do. That's the way I would eat plants if I had to. So that's the way I would eat plants if I had
And
to.
it's really interesting that it's completely turned around because most people are really concerned that when they start eating an animal-based diet, that they will get nutrient deficiencies for, like minerals or vitamins. And the way you are talking about it, it's completely turned around. Because if you eat an all-meat diet, can you meet all your nutritional needs?
Oh, it does. And the funny thing is that when you add in plants, especially unprocessed plants that haven't been put through these chemical changes, they also defend themselves by not having bioavailability, protecting their own nutrients, but also having anti-nutrients that block out, bind, and disrupt your own digestion of nutrients so that you can't absorb the even the freely available nutrients that are in meat and other sorts of things, or even the plants that you're eating. So that's another way that even the available sort of nutrients still come out, and then these anti-nutrients bind them, block them, you can't absorb them. Or different things. There's a class of these things like saponins, other sorts of things that are digestive disruptors that will block things like protease and lipase, which are enzymes from our pancreas that break down proteins and fat so that we can absorb them. Now you've blocked that enzyme, so now meat isn't bioavailable, but also plant proteins aren't bioavailable, and plant proteins are much less bioavailable anyway in their natural form. But it's interesting because you're thinking, well, have some fruits and vegetables, it's not that big a deal, let's plant toxins aside, maybe it just adds some vitamins and minerals to it, just some extra stuff. Great, like a vitamin. Well, no, actually, it actually block out a lot of the nutrients in your food. I mean, I even medications. So I have patients that are on thyroid medication. So I have hypothyroidism, and I had a few ladies actually that came in, and men too, but specifically a couple women came in the last couple weeks or last month or so, and then came in again recently. And their thyroid load, their T3 specifically, which is the active form of thyroid hormone. So I always check that because you don't always convert T4 into T3. So it's not good enough to just to check that. And so I was checking their T3, and their T3 was very low, like at the levels that they were before they were prescribed thyroid medication. And they were specifically on slow release T3, meaning that it shouldn't have been a conversion issue. They should just have enough T3. But they didn't. They had very low levels. And so I asked them, I was like, did you come off your medication? Did something change? And I said, no, I'm still on the medication every morning. And I sort of did some digging, asking them how they took it. And it turns out that they were having coffee around the same time or shortly after they took the medication or even with the medication. And it was completely blocking out of the absorption of their thyroid hormone. And so then I said, okay, well, just delay the coffee. Don't even, if you don't want to stop coffee, fine. Some, one of them did stop coffee, but the other one, just delay it for at least 2 hours and don't have any plants with breakfast, just only the thyroid hormone. Don't eat anything. Don't have anything except water for half an hour. You can have a meat-based breakfast after that. You can take your other medications, but no plants or coffee for 2 hours. See what happens. And two of these ladies, their T3 doubled. And so it just massively came up. Another lady had actually literally tripled her T3, actually tripled to the point that she was actually too high now. So without the coffee and without eating that way, and her thyroid medication was actually too strong. She didn't need nearly as much anymore. So we reduced her dose. And so you're not missing anything. You get everything you need in the proportion you need it from meat, fatty meat. That's really important, is the fat. The fat are essential nutrients. It's not just a calorie source. So you don't just avoid it because you're trying to lose weight or lose fat. Oh, I already have fat, so I don't need fat. No, you do need fat because they're essential fat soluble or fatty acids that you have to have or you get sick and die. And they're essential fatty or fat soluble nutrients that you have to have or you get sick and die. And so you need these things. I check people's nutrients, vitamins, minerals, these sorts of things when they still have are dabbling with a clean omnivorous diet. Oh, I have a really good diet. Okay, what does that mean to you? Well, it's usually more plants, less meat, but no junk food, things like that. Their vitamins and minerals are very low and across the board. And so then you change their diet, these things all start coming up into more optimal ranges, and their health improves dramatically as well. And it's not just from the nutrients. There are a lot of other things that are going on. But when they're including things like coffee or including other sorts of plants and things like that, you'll actually see they're just not absorbing the same amount of nutrients. And you say, okay, can you cut those out and just not eat those with the meat? Just have a separation between when you eat the meat and when you eat fruits and vegetables and coffee. And they do that. And their nutrients come right up. So there's a good study that illustrated one of these such sort of events where they had people that ate oysters, and oysters are replete with zinc. It's the best dietary source of zinc. Beef is second, but beef is like 10% of the zinc that's in oysters. So oysters are hands down number one. And so they gave people these oysters. They checked their serum levels of zinc and actually jumped up. Let's call it 100. So they went up 100, right? And so 100%. And then they gave them the same amount of oysters, but with black beans. And their zinc only went up 25, right? So it was 75% was blocked out. And then they gave the same amount of oysters to people with corn tortillas. And it was zero. They did not rise at all, right? So 100% of the zinc in the oysters was blocked out from absorption. So we think that, oh, it's not that big of a deal. There's all these nutrients in there, but the nutrients that go in your mouth are not necessarily the nutrients that get into your body. And that's really important. That's a major, major way that plants defend themselves, is by not allowing you to thrive on the food that you're eating, so that you are not successful, that you are not the dominant, that you are not the one that's going around having a bunch of kids and then teaching those little sticky bastards to come back and eat that plant, right? So it's a multi-generational defense, right? One of the easiest ways to understand that we haven't been eating plants for this long is we don't have that natural machinery to circumvent the bioavailability issue, break those chemical bonds, deal with these anti-nutrients, deal with these toxins. But also we look genetically, people say, well, if we're carnivores, then why do we make amylase, right? Which breaks down starches. It's a very good question. But a better question is, when did we start making amylase? Have we always made amylase? Has it been going on for 2 million years? No. It's been going on for about 10,000 years with the advent of agriculture. So that is a very recent genetic adaptation. Same with lactose persistence or lactase persistence, where we've been able to be lactose tolerant. That's 12 to 15,000 years that that started coming into the genome, because these megafauna died out and we needed other sources of food, nutrition, and specifically fat. So we went to dairy so we could get the milk and skim the cream and go after the fat. Skim milk was a throwaway product. They used to give it to pigs to actually fatten them up. Up until very recently, I found a paper in the 1930s that found the best way to fatten up pigs for slaughter for lard was giving them grains and skim milk, and that made them overeat and just eat and eat and eat voraciously. So they just gained massive amounts of weight and massive amounts of fat, and you could get a lot of lard out of them. And that's, I mean, grains and skim milk, that's breakfast cereal. That's what every kid around the world is being fed all the time. And we wonder why we have an obesity problem. But, amylase was only came into the genome about 10,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture. And obviously that makes sense. And so these agricultural, post-agricultural societies that spread very quickly because that was obviously a survival advantage because we radically changed the way we're eating. And so, so it's, you do definitely get everything you need. Easy way of looking at this, Inuit exist, right? It's also sometimes called the Eskimo. They live in the Arctic Circle now, and until very recently, they weren't able to ship up and fly up huge amounts of Ruffles, Doritos, and Coca-Cola and booze and all these
Fast
other sorts
food,
of different things, that we eat. And so they were just eating meat. And there are many books written about them. Many anthropologists, paleoanthropologists, and explorers, polar explorers wrote copious amounts of books and scholarly articles on them, showing that this is what they ate. They ate extremely high fat as a proportion of the plate. If you had 100 grams of meat, 50 grams of that were fat. So these are a very high fat diet. So that's like 3-4 grams of fat to 1 gram of protein at that point. So it's a very high fat diet, and they don't get sick. They don't get these diseases of civilization, which is what anthropologists call this. When populations go to a post-agricultural way of living, they get diseases of civilization, which is the heart disease and cancer and diabetes and so on, autoimmunity. And before that, they don't get these things. They don't get them living their traditional ways. And so, if meat and fat were the cause of this, then obviously that would be a problem. And so if we couldn't get everything that we need in the proportion that we need it from fatty meat, they knew it couldn't be alive right now. And Homo habilis would not have survived the ice ages. And our ancestors living in the Arctic Circle during the ice ages would not be able to survive. And the people crossing the land bridge from Asia to North America to populate both North and South America would never have made it, because that was in the Arctic Circle during an ice age, 1,500 miles north of what is now Seattle, and where Seattle was under a mile high block of ice, right? And you're 1,500 miles north of that. What did that look like? So we just from basic observation of the world around us, you don't need a study to tell you that, just like you don't need a study to tell you that parachutes are a good idea if you're jumping out of a plane. You can just look and see that's a bad idea when people fall out of a plane without a parachute, and looks like it's okay with, or it's better with, a parachute. So, there is evidence that exists outside of a randomized controlled trial, and we can just use our eyes and see, well, this is what humans have been living on and thriving on for millions of years, and we have not had these issues, and we have not had the chronic health issues we've had in the current populations within the past 150 years, 200 years since they've switched to a more agricultural-based diet. We have seen that shift. We've seen that shift from very healthy people that live a very long time, over 100, 110, 115 years by their own records, which sounds far-fetched, but we know as geneticists that we're designed to live 120 years on average. And that's exactly what they're saying. They're eating the way we're supposed to eat. They're living the way we're supposed to live. And they're living as long as we know we should be living. It all lines up. I mean, it's not like it's like, something doesn't fit here. It all makes sense. And then when they change the way they're eating, change the way they're living, life expectancy goes down. Their height goes down. They don't develop as well. They drop on average 5 inches of height. Their brain shrink by 11%. Immediately after the agricultural revolution, the average cranial capacity of adult males shrank by 11% and 17% for women, and that has persisted until today. And it wasn't hundreds of years or thousands of years of development; it was right away overnight. And now we're seeing that in real time with these native pre-agricultural populations moving to a post-agricultural way of living, and we see those exact same disparities that we saw 10,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It just made me think. I've been orthomolecular therapist before, so I would have to prescribe lots of vitamins, minerals, supplements, and everything. People always worry, do I get enough vitamin C? Do I get enough this? Do I get enough that? But they never think that these recommendations are made for people eating a modern diet, high in glucose, high in carbs. And in my experience, people who are going back to their primal diet, their meat-based, low-carb, high-fat diets, they need less supplementation because, well, all the recommendations are not for them. How do you see that? Because it's completely turned around.
No, you're exactly right. And if you need supplements, then by definition your diet is deficient, right? Now that could be for a lot of different things. The soil health has really gone south because of our agricultural practices with crop agriculture. We're basically mining minerals and vitamins out of the soil, and we're not replacing them. And so if the soil is depleted, the food is going to be depleted all the way up the food chain. And so, that doesn't come from animal agriculture, because animal agriculture actually recycles these nutrients, and the manure and the fur and the urine go back in. And actually you're drinking out of this, river or pond over here, and you're going and peeing all over the field, and you're actually irrigating it. You're bringing in moisture, you're bringing in water, you're bringing in nutrients, vitamins, and minerals that the plants require, that they really need to be as healthy as they can be. So, it's so common now that people take vitamins and minerals because you just have to, because everybody's just deficient in everything. And that we just forget that that's not actually normal, that that's not how, koalas don't take supplements, they don't take vitamins, and Native Americans didn't either. And 100 years ago, 200 years ago, we really didn't have these nutritional supplements. And then and some people died of nutritional abnormalities and malnutrition. That was a real thing that we faced, but not in the native populations when they were just eating a traditional diet. It's only when you're eating a post-agricultural diet, and it's specifically a very nutritionally depleted processed food diet, and it's processed plants, it's not processed meats, it's really processed plants that makes up the bulk of the processed food industry. They're really devoid of nutrients. As a friend of mine, Peter Ballerstedt, who was at the Switzerland meeting as well, I'm sure you met him there. Something he says, which is that we're overfed and undernourished. We're getting tons and tons of calories and energy, and we're getting no vitamins and minerals. And because we aren't, we just are craving more and more food because we need those nutrients. And there's other sort of hormonal effects that these processed foods have to give us chemical responses to make us overeat. Then they sell more products, so that's in their best interest. It's not in our best interest by any stretch of the imagination. But if you need supplements, then by definition, your diet is deficient. Eating meat, eating fatty meat, is going to make you improve your nutrition status from any point. It may be that to get the best of the best levels, you might add in some organs, but organs are nature's vitamins. Like you don't really need, unless you have something like pernicious anemia where you just physically can't absorb B12 because of an autoimmune condition, then you have to get it sublingually or by injection. Just adding in a bit of liver will cover you for all your B vitamins and B vitamin needs, folate, B12, everything, and some of the other organs too. So that's really all you need, is just eating the whole animal. And most people do amazingly well just on the muscle meat, not even including organs. And so it's not even always necessary. The very clear evidence as to how malnourished we are is that the reference ranges on the lab tests are actually getting lower and lower and lower, because the reference ranges are not an optimal reference range set. All reference ranges at every single lab on Earth, even in your own city, they're all different. They said, well, in different areas, it matters. No, it really doesn't. You need the same amount of B12 whether you're in Denmark, London, or Saskatchewan. Like you just need a certain amount of B12. Just because you took a trip over to another continent that has a different reference range, you're not all of a sudden deficient or normal. You're either deficient or you're not. You're either replete or you're not. And so these, and especially in the same town, well, it's the same environment, right? So why do they have different reference ranges? Because the reference ranges are an average for that local community. And so the first 2,000 people that come into that lab, that becomes the reference range. And every few years, they renorm the reference ranges and they change them again. So as people are moving more and more plant-based, B12 only exists from a nutrition, from a dietary perspective, from a natural food perspective, from meat.
Yeah.
And so if you don't eat meat, and you're, and most people in Europe and America and elsewhere are mostly plant-based, 75 to 80% of the calories that we get are as a population in Western countries are from plants, largely carbohydrates and processed foods and carbohydrates, but it's plants. And people say, oh, we need to go plant-based. We're already plant-based. It's not working. We need to go meat-based, right? And yeah, we need to get rid of this processed garbage and get nutritionally dense food. And so, you know, when you're, you know, when we've been doing that, all these reference ranges have been going south, 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 south. And now since everybody's nutritionally deficient, everybody has low B12, it's hidden in the averages. So we think that no one is deficient. Because everyone's deficient now, no one's deficient, but people are deficient. So there are studies that look at averages for populations in their 20s that don't have, that are normal BMI and don't have any diagnosed medical issues. Those reference ranges are wildly different. And then you look at different scientific studies looking at what is an optimal range and where do you need to be above and what's like the baseline, et cetera. Very different reference ranges. I'll give an example for the UK. UK, in a lot of areas, will go for B12 picomoles per liter, which is most of Europe will do this.
Mm-hmm.
Goes down to 130, 150. Some will even say if it's above 150, you're good. Don't worry about it, right? Okay. So, yeah. But below 150, oh, okay, yeah, no, that's a mild deficiency. And then below, you know, 120 or 100, oh, okay, yeah, you know, you should really do something about it. Okay. University of Oxford did a study published in 2008 that showed that sort of below, I think it was below 330 or 350 picomoles per liter, you know, so over double what they're saying. That on MRI, they did MRIs of the brain every year. And after 5 years, these people that had below that level of 330, 350, their brain shrank by over 5% volume, right? So that is a clear deficiency. You're actually getting brain damage by having that little B12. And yet you're saying that's in the middle of the range because it goes from 130 to 500, 540. There's a lot of ranges in the UK go up to that. I would call 540 a clear deficiency. In fact, the optimal reference ranges that have been found through different experimental, you know, design, saying, okay, what is the best place for us to be, is about 800 to 1200 picomoles per liter. So that's what I like to see my patients at. And so, you know, what I tell people is, you know, when they say what their B12 is, oh yeah, my doctor checked the B12 and it's fine. It's like, okay. Yeah. So if your B12 wasn't high, it's low. That's sort of it. Some reference ranges the upper limit will get into the proper range, what I would consider an optimal range. Most of them don't. And so most people are nutritionally deficient and they don't even realize it, even on all of these supplements that they're taking. And a lot of it can be due. I mean, you know, you take your vitamins in the morning with your coffee, you're not absorbing any of those things. There's just not a chance in hell. And depending on what you eat them with, you're not getting much either. So it's, and if you just eat meat and you cut all those things out, I see people's levels come up to what I would consider an optimal level very quickly. Yeah. And they maintain that way. And some people need a bit of organs, and that's pretty much it. And most people don't, actually, as long as you're getting high quality meat. You know, there are the rare people that have pernicious anemia and simply don't absorb B12 properly. And even when they're on a meat only diet and they're eating liver, I've found that people's B12 just kept dropping down, you know, under 400. I was like, okay, well, what the hell is going on here? Check them for pernicious anemia, and they had the antibodies for pernicious anemia. Okay, that's great. So it wasn't a complete one at that point, right? But you get damaged to the point that you're just not absorbing very much. Okay, so they need supplementation. But that's a very specific situation. And normal people in their normal conditions that don't have a malabsorption issue, have a specific medical issue, you just need to eat meat, maybe some organs, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. One of the supplements people are taking on a ketogenic or a carnivore diet is electrolytes, salt. But is it correct that you've stopped taking salt with your diet?
Yeah, I don't really salt anything anymore. I always tell people just salt to taste. Your body can sort of figure it out. At this point, salt doesn't taste good to me. It tastes too salty. And there is definitely sodium in meat. You get quite a lot of it, and your body adjusts to how much you need it. It's been sort of, thrown out there that we really haven't pursued salt in to the extent that we have now, where we're having huge mining excavation of old salt mines and dehydrating big tracts of seawater and things like that to get salt until after the agricultural revolution. And that so you didn't really need mineral salt as much if you were, it's not that you necessarily avoided it, but and animals in the wild, if there's something salty, they'll lick it and things like that. And great, that's fine. But if we didn't put salt licks out for deers, would all the deers die? No, they're still fine. So I just went by taste, and at first I actually salted pretty heavily, and that's what tasted good to me. And then I just slowly used slightly less salt and slightly less salt until I just didn't want it anymore, and it tasted best without it. And so that's what I do. Early on, when you convert to a ketogenic diet, you can, when your insulin starts coming down, you may get some disruptions in your electrolytes. And so insulin helps draw in, well, it actually forces you to draw back in a lot of electrolytes, sodium, et cetera, in your kidneys at multiple levels in the microtubules. And so when you go ketogenic and your insulin comes down, you can actually sort of pull the rug out from under your kidneys, and all of a sudden you're spilling out too many electrolytes. But think about it this way: you weren't born with insulin resistance. In fact, you were born in ketosis. And when you're breastfeeding, you're in ketosis. And this is very important for your brain. Being in ketosis, you can grow your brain properly. But over the years, you build up this insulin resistance. You're eating more carbohydrates. You're having these swings in insulin. You're generally having your insulin be, higher than you would normally in a normal ketogenic state. And so that's actually drawing in an inappropriate amount of sodium, right? So your kidneys have to compensate the other way and actually draw out more than they normally would to have that homeostasis and that balance, because too many electrolytes, too much sodium and potassium in your blood will kill you just as fast as too little potassium and sodium. And so your body can compensate in one direction, it can compensate right back the other direction. It's just with the speed that we go into a ketogenic diet and we have this drop off in your insulin, that can sort of leave your kidneys in a bit of a lurch. And so early on, people may find that they're spilling out more electrolytes, they'll get hypovolemia, they might get orthostatic hypotension, where they stand up and they drop their blood pressure and they get very dizzy, and they might actually have to sit back down and before they fall down. In that case, you add in a bit more salt and you drink more water. It's a dehydration issue, and that salt actually pulls out more water and you get dehydrated. So, Professor Steve Finney has been studying ketogenic diets for 30 plus years. He's shown that in a ketogenic state, you sometimes need to add as much as 5 to 7 grams of salt a day, and that's what you need. But I've found that when your insulin normalizes and you become more keto adapted, that your kidneys recompensate, and they go back to just balancing, being balanced out for the level of insulin that you have. Now, it could be that some people still need to add salt, and that's why I say just salt to taste and to what makes you feel good. For me, I don't use anymore. The only person I've ever met that was also at the conference, Dave Feldman. It is the only person I've ever met that years onto a ketogenic diet, he still needs to add, more than 5 grams of salt a day. He's keto. He still has plants and other sorts of things as well. So I don't know if that still applies to people not eating plants at all in a purely pre-agricultural sort of way of eating. But there are a lot of people, the old school carnivores, and it used to be called zero carbers. So it'd be a zero carb diet, but it was really a zero plant diet. And they would just do just meat, just water, and they would actually say, don't eat salt. And so these people have been doing this for decades and 30, 40, 50 years. And a lot of them are saying, you don't need any salt, don't have salt. If you're only eating meat, you don't need salt. And so that was the teaching in these groups was when you switch to a meat-only diet, cut out salt too. And so a lot of people do that and seem to be fine. Get enough water. Obviously, if you're getting or these drops in your blood pressure and you're feeling kind of gross, I don't think it's a problem to add a bit of salt early on and then just salt to taste. And if your body's still wants salt, I don't have too much of a problem with that. I don't use it at all now. I remember trying at one point when I still did salt, and I thought, by these people's examples, well, maybe I'll just try stopping salt and see if that makes a big difference. I didn't notice too much of a difference. It's just my food tasted a bit bland. And so I went back to sort of adding a bit of salt. And then about a year later, I just naturally phased it out. I just didn't really want it. Even when I put a very light amount of salt on it, just to sort of help dry the meat in my fridge for dry aging purposes. I actually found it was just too salty and I didn't really like it. So I was like, all right, well, maybe I'll just do this without. I was like, yeah, that actually it tastes perfectly salted to me at that point. So, that's what I did.
Well, it's a good point to make anyway. Keep listening to your own body, to your own taste, and adjust along the process. It's not a dogma you have to follow for years and years and years. Just listen to your own body.
Yeah, definitely.
We've been talking for a long time already, but I have one final question.
Sure.
Because you're getting a lot of pushback from all over the world, what challenges have you faced in promoting the carnivore diet with in the medical community?
In my immediate circles, none. Everybody that I've spoken to is actually in agreement with what I'm doing, and they're actually quite interested in it. And when I talk to them about it and I discuss the science behind it and show them the evidence behind it, they actually get very interested in it, and most of them actually try it. It's the people that haven't spoken to me, that haven't actually looked into it. Those are the ones that are like, oh yeah, no, that's crazy. Well, is it? Because you haven't actually given it a fair shake. It's like John Stuart Mill, the American philosopher, said in the 1800s, if you only know your side of the argument, then you don't know much. If you haven't heard the argument from the opposite side in its most compelling form, from its most ardent supporter, then you don't even know what the argument is. You don't even know what the discussion is. You just know straw man that say, well, this is what they're saying and this is why they're wrong. Okay, but is that what they're saying? Most people will say that I hear people saying that people in the carnivore community or in the ketogenic space are making claims that no one is making. They're not making the arguments that they're not representing the arguments that we're making at all. They're making straw man caricatures of the arguments. And so the people that and doctors in particular that have specifically sat down and talked to me, and when you're in surgery, you're in there for several hours and sometimes 12 hours, 20 hours, you have a lot of time to talk. And so you're obviously concentrating, but you have a lot of people, and you're having conversations as you're going, and this comes up. And so I'll be operating and I'll be with have a couple teams. All of a sudden, one of the surgeons from the other team will just say, like, so I saw your podcast. I'm like, you saw my podcast? Like, what are you talking about? And they're just like, yeah, so it makes sense. It makes sense what you're saying. And they'd ask questions about it. So we just have these conversations. And I can when I'm speaking to someone who's in the medical community and they've taken the scientific background classes and have this understanding of human physiology, it's actually easier to talk to them. It's actually easier to explain this to them because I don't have to sort of explain basic physiology to them. I could just talk at a high level to them, and they're like, yeah, I get that. And talk about specific studies that we were all taught, and it's like, well, okay, well, these are the flaws in these studies, and this is what this evidence shows, and this is how there's a better evidence that shows X, Y, and Z. And they're like, ah, that makes perfect sense, and all these other sorts of things. So, it's I haven't had any pushback in any with any doctor that I've ever spoken to personally. Never. It's just the internet trolls and the different media outlets that try to misrepresent what I'm saying. And then they try to do that. They even try to misrepresent my credentials and try to downplay the fact that I'm a doctor, or try to say that I'm an alternative medicine practitioner, and they won't address me as doctor or all these sorts of things. The Guardian came out with an article like that. It was yeah. extremely demeaning, and as much as they could be. And I actually wrote the editor and say, this is extremely misleading, defamatory, the way that you've presented this, and that this needs to be adjusted. And they made some adjustments. I need to go back to them and tell them they need to make more adjustments that are ridiculous. And just making up statistics, they said that the beef industry got $36 billion in subsidies from the US government. It's like, no, it didn't. I mean, that's insane. And that fruits and vegetables only got 17 million subsidies total. It's like, okay, if you just go to the official government website and look at the statistics, you'll see that the most heavily subsidized foodstuffs in America are corn, wheat, and soy, right? And that beef and the cattle industry, the meat industry, gets subsidized at about $400 million a year, not $36 billion a year. And just oranges were getting $500 million a year, right? $500 million a year. It was more than the beef. So if you're not calling soy and corn and wheat fruits or vegetables, okay, technically they're grains or seeds or whatever. So, oh, okay. Well, you can, and again, that's a completely misleading. Well, we're not talking about, we were talking about specifically leaves and fruits. Okay, fine. But that's wrong too, because just oranges is $400 million in subsidies. So where is this $17 million a year nonsense coming up for all fruits and vegetables? It's just pure hokum. And I pointed that out, and I sent them the official government website that showed the subsidies that were given for all of these things, and showed that their statistics were fraudulent, and showed them that, say, hey, look, you reference this other article that was an opinion piece that referenced something else, and it had a link for this, and you click on that link and the link is broken. It doesn't go anywhere. So, how can you do that? I mean, why do you not have a research team fact checking these things and making sure you have accurate data? You know, and I've done this for you, and I'm showing you the official government website showing that this is the case. They said, well, we have this link and we have this reference, so that's the one we're going to use. I'm like, that's fraudulent. That is pure fraud. So you get those sorts of people. But actual doctors, no, I have doctors contacting me via LinkedIn and other sort of social media outlets, email, etc., telling me how they think that this is really beneficial and helpful, and that they're doing it themselves and they're applying it to their patients. I go to conferences, medical conferences, ketogenic medical conferences, other medical conferences, and I get people coming up to me, that are anesthesiologists and pain specialists and oncologists and neurosurgeons and general surgeons and all these other sorts of things, and radiologists, and coming up and like, hey, I do carnivore. It's amazing. I've been applying it to my patients. We're getting massive improvements, all these other sorts of things. So in the actual medical community, I've actually found a very favorable response, a very, very positive response. It's the online goofs and trolls that are the problem. And these are people that simply haven't looked into it. They simply haven't given it a fair shake. They simply haven't sat there with an open mind and thought that maybe what they learned in medical school or in college wasn't actually correct. And that's really important. I mean, it goes back to like the 1930s. There's a very famous address at the Harvard Medical School, and the deans of medicine there said to the graduating class, I think it was like 1936 or something like that, he said, half of what you've learned here in medical school at Harvard will turn out to be wrong, but no one's going to tell you which half, because nobody knows. And so you're going to have to keep doing your own research. You're going to have to keep thinking. You're going to have to keep asking questions and keep experimenting in your own practice and see what works and what doesn't. It goes back to Hippocrates. We said, don't just do things because people have always done them, like, praying to Apollo and hoping something happens. Do things that work. Do the things that work consistently. And if you find something that works better, you do that instead. And that was the basis of Western scientific-based medicine, was this scientific process of trial and error and experiment to try to get the best outcome. And that's what we're doing. You know, when we have like, well, this is what we're taught in medical school and residency to treat condition X. And then you find that these nutritional interventions actually work better for, say, diabetes and for autoimmunity and for congestive heart failure and for MS and for Alzheimer's and for all these other sorts of mental health issues, schizophrenia, all these other sorts of things. How can you not do that? You say, no, we're supposed to do the guidelines. That's like praying to Apollo. That's just trying to do the same thing and praying that it works. And even though it goes contrary to the direct evidence in front of your face. So I think it is unethical, immoral, and malpractice to know about an intervention that's better and withhold that from your patients and not tell them about it because you're just afraid that the medical board is going to have a problem with you stepping out on your own and not following the guidelines. The guidelines are a guideline. They are there to help guide you when you don't really know what the hell you're doing. And at least you just stay on this path and you won't get in too much trouble, right? But then when you learn more and you become more expert in your field, you see what really works and what doesn't. And that's what you need to do. And that's the only ethical standard that you can really abide by as a conscientious physician.
Totally agree. A very strong point to make. Yes, thank you very much. And I'm very, very happy that you're spearheading this, that you're out there taking all the hits as well, because it's quite beastly sometimes. Well, thank you so much for this talk. Anyone wanting to discover more about you and your work, where can they find you?
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's really good to see you again. I'm on YouTube. My channel is just Anthony Chafee, MD, and I have hundreds of videos and longer videos, interviews like this, ones on specific topics, and also clips from longer videos on specific things that like we would have talked about today, and maybe clip those into sort of 10, 15-minute chunks that are a bit easier to digest. And I'm also on social media, so Instagram, same thing, Anthony Chafee MD, Twitter, Anthony underscore Chafee, and and other things as well. But those can usually be found through those social media sites. And those are the main ones, though, and a podcast, of course. I have a podcast called The Plant Free MD, which shouldn't surprise anybody about the name, but it's sort of to grab people's attention. And and so if people want to listen to it on podcast form, they can do that. And or if they want to go on YouTube and see the videos, they can do that there. And that's it. So I don't put things behind paywalls. I'm not trying to do this as a job. I have a job. I like my job. I work very hard to get to my job, and I want to keep doing that. And I didn't go to medical school to be an online personality or an influencer. So I make these things available for people because I want the information out there so people can use it and not have to pay to be healthy. The natural state of humanity is that of health. The natural state of all life on earth is that of health. And so we have an innate birthright to be healthy. And the fact that we're not because we're being hurt for good intention. We've had good intentions to try to limit fat, eat more fruits and vegetables, and all these sorts of things because that's what's supposed to help us. We listened to that. It was wrong and it's hurting people. And so it's just to let people know and get this information out there so they can make these positive health choices for themselves and just not be sick all the time. And so yeah, they can find it more there.
Yes, and thank you so much for all of that. I'll put the show notes in the links in the show notes so people can easily find you. And I'm looking forward to meeting you again someday, hopefully in Switzerland next year.
That would be great. Definitely
That'd be
planning to
great.
go there again. I loved that conference. Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, thank you again, and
Thank
till
you.
next time.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Ik hoop dat je Anthony Chafee wat beter hebt leren kennen en dat je net als ik gefascineerd bent door wat hij allemaal te vertellen heeft. En wil je nou meer leren over de effecten van ketogene diëten, waar het carnivore dieet ook bij hoort, dan is de opleiding Ketogene Metabolotherapie misschien wel wat voor jou. Klik op de link in de show notes en lees er meer over op onze website. Of doe eens mee met het gratis webinar Ketonen de vierde brandstof, wat ik regelmatig geef. Ook daarvoor vind je een link in de show notes. Dankjewel voor het luisteren naar deze podcast. Mijn naam is Lucia Blikkenhorst en graag tot de volgende keer.